Moscow-Aim. Here's a partial list of well-known musicians who have performed playing a Martin guitar. Willie Nelson, Johnny Cash, Kurt Cobain, Nico Case, Loudon Wainwright III, Eric Clapton, Mumford & Sons, and many, many more. Christian Frederick Martin immigrated to the U.S. in 1833 and opened a guitar shop in New York City near the site of today's Lincoln Tunnel. 2 decades later, he moved to rural Pennsylvania, the current headquarters of C.F. Martin & Company, where its famous guitars are made. Our guest, Peter Sago, has co-edited a new book titled Inventing the American Guitar, which is about the evolution of guitar making in the 19th century and the important role that Martin played. Also with us is Dick Boak. He's director of museum archives and special projects for Martin Guitar, where he has worked for more than 3 decades. And I'm so thrilled to say that I am sitting here staring at 4 beautiful Martin guitars and also staring at our 2 guests. And Peter Sago, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And Dick Boak, nice to have you with us as well.
It's great to be here.
And nice to have you here. And there's so much history that I do want to talk about, but I also want to talk about the fact, Peter, is that you have brought in 4 absolutely beautiful guitars. What is the unique sound you think you get from a Martin guitar that you get from the earliest one to the sound that you get today?
Well, what's remarkable is that one gets the Martin sound from the very earliest guitars to the current guitars. And the earliest ones are tiny, but they have a really big resonant sound.
Is that how you see it, Dick?
Pretty much. You know, it was always a combination of craftsmanship, the finest materials, and a focus on tone.
And a focus on tone. Mm-hmm. But, and a recognizable tone?
Yeah, and also a very lightness of weight. The Martin guitars, you pick them up, they feel like potato chips. They're just so light. And I think the lightness in weight contributes to the tone. Most guitars are overbuilt.
Oh.
And produce kind of a thick, heavy sound. Martin guitars have a resonant, projective tone.
Well, I do actually want to have you strum this really old Martin guitar that you have sitting next to you here. And Peter, perhaps you could describe what this guitar is all about, or the history of this guitar.
Yes, the one that Dick's about to play is remarkable. It's actually the earliest extant Martin guitar, built within a year of his arriving in America. And it is very Germanic. It's a tiny body. It has a scroll headstock like a contemporary Fender guitar or almost the silhouette of a violin. It has a fingerboard that is lifted off the body of the guitar, which was pretty advanced at that point in time. And it's beautifully, beautifully decorated, as are most of his guitars.
And where did you find this very early Martin guitar?
Well, this one actually belongs in the Martin Museum. I don't know where it came from.
Do you know?
Well,
Dick?
You know, I think it was actually sold to a customer in the early 1800s, and then it came back for repair. And for some reason, I think the Martin family purchased it back, probably in the 1850s.
Wow!
But it is wonderful. It's light as a feather. And surprising, all the guitars of this time period were strung with gut strings, intestines from sheep or goats, lamb, which is a fun image, isn't it?
Yes, it is a very fun image.
But the steel strings didn't come into considerably later. But the Martin guitars were known for very early on for the tone, and that's what drew the musicians toward them. So I'll play a little bit here.
That'd be great. Just play for us.
I don't know. When you deal with guitars every day, you know, we all have our little riffs that we use to show off the sound. And I'm not Eric Clapton. Eric could, you know,
That's okay.
We could do. He'd be doing that.
Well, I'm glad you did what you did. And what strikes me, and perhaps this is also true of this kind of guitar, is just the warmth of sound coming out of that very small body. Can you talk about that? Just the warmth of sound.
Well, you know, this is an anomaly, really. The early guitars were made with maple, which is really a very projective sound. Very soon on, he changed over to rosewood, which is typically from this time period from Brazil.
Right.
It's restricted now. But the rosewood has a much warmer sound. I think the warmth of this guitar comes largely from the strings. A guitar is really like a drum, with the spruce top being like the drum head, the vibrating member, and the back and sides being reflective. Mm-hmm. And maple is very reflective. And
it's a beautiful little guitar. What can I say? Peter, let me turn back to you and help us understand C.F. Martin. He came to the United States in the 1830s, came and settled in New York City, part of a wave of what, German immigrants coming to this country?
Yes, and he came with a number of other luthiers from the same area. He had studied with one of the finest guitar makers in Vienna for many years.
Johann Stauffer?
Yes, Johann Stauffer. And he set up a music store which actually did everything, not only making guitars, but he'd sell any kind of musical instrument. He'd do repairs. He was making a living.
Flugelhorns, clarinets, everything you can imagine, and selling a lot of strings. And it's amazing to see the transactions. It'll be 4.5 cents, 8.5 cents.
Guitar. And bartering.
Right,
bartering as well.
Well,
this was a city
wine.
Teeming of with immigrants, right?
Well, New York City was a pretty tough place at the time. There was pigs and horses and sheep and fighting in the streets, and pretty much the way New York is today. But they actually were unhappy in New York. They really missed their homeland, and one of the stories is that his wife Ottilia broke into tears at Christmas time and wanted to move back to Germany, but instead visited friends in Nazareth that had settled in Millgrove, just north of Nazareth, close to where we are today, and she fell in love with the town. Everybody was German-speaking. It was settled by the Moravians, and she went back to New York. Read the riot act to her husband, sold the property in New York City, and we wish they hadn't, because it would be worth about $1 billion.
I bet it
today.
Would. I bet it would.
And moved out to Nazareth, where they really focused on guitars.
Coincidentally, when we started researching for the book, we presumed we were going to find all sorts of guitar makers in America that preceded C.F. Martin. In fact, we found only one. And he was from the same neighborhood, the same village as Martin in Germany, and he simply came over 3 years before Martin. He settled in Pennsylvania, so Martin probably had a good sense of where he was headed.
Who was he making instruments for? Was it for, you know, quote unquote, regular folk who played musical instruments?
I think that at that point in time, the guitar was not anywhere as popular as it would become. He was probably making most instruments, and again, he made them in very small batches.
Right.
He would be making them by request for teachers, perhaps for professional performers, for some retailers.
And he was obviously working off this German design that he had that he brought over to the country.
Yes.
But that changed over time. Go ahead, Dick. Looks like you want to
say
something.
Yeah, a Viennese design, really. And you know, a lot of the players were women. A much higher percentage of women players than there are now. But we're seeing a resurgence, and that's really good, because everybody knows the women are smarter and more talented. But
the men are good-looking.
That's right.
You know.
That's right. The men were off making war and doing business. A lot of the guitars, like Peter said, were sold through music teachers that were kind of like the early distributors of guitars. The guitars were, during this time period and through the end of the century, called parlor guitars, which kind of refers to how they were used. They were used as kind of cultural entertainment in the homes. There was no radios or anything, no national public radio.
No national public radio.
And So, and that's why I think women at tea time often entertained their guests, and men that were cultural, there was a pretty big focus on being intelligent, cultured, refined, musical, you know, writing, and I think all those things were just part of the late 1800s and in this time period.
And Peter, are these guitars small because they were made for women, or that was just really the size of the guitar at that time in the 19th century?
That was the size of the guitar, and as a matter of fact, Martin didn't know how to make bigger ones.
Really?
And that was, of course, one of the things he learned very quickly. I wanted to just mention, regarding women, one of our many discoveries for the book, and it's certainly one of the most engaging, was a portrait painted in 1834. So that was within a year of Martin's arrival in New York, of a clearly young gentlewoman playing a Martin guitar.
Hmm.
And there it is, one of the earliest of Martin guitars.
And that's Madame de Gauny? Is that who that is?
No, we actually don't know who the subject is. The painter is George Healy, who was a very prolific portrait painter.
But the book also talks about this evolution of the guitar. He comes to this country with this inspiration or influence of this Viennese guitar maker. But before long, he's being influenced by ideas about the Spanish guitar. Can you talk about that?
Yes. One of his teacher customers was named John Cooper, isn't it?
John Cooper.
Yeah. And he was Spanish. He was not only a teacher, he was a composer and a virtuoso performer as well. And as early as 1838, 1837, so that's within, 4 or 5 years of Martin's arrival, Cooper was ordering guitars in the Spanish style. And within 2 or 3 years after that, Martin was actually making guitars that were remarkably similar to Spanish guitars he might have seen on the New York stage played by Spanish virtuosi.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break, and I want to talk more about this evolution of the American guitar and the Spanish influence as well. That's Peter Zago, and he's a scholar, he's a collector and of American guitars and banjos, also co-author of this new book called Inventing the American Guitar, The Pre-Civil War Innovations of C.F. Martin and His Contemporaries. Also with us is Dick Boak, and he's director of Museum Archives and Special Projects for Martin Guitar. He's a writer. He's a graphic artist. He's a woodworker as well. He has worked at Martin Guitar for over 30 years. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. And this note, New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art is mounting a Martin Guitar exhibit starting on January 14th. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Flashpoint Theater supports WHYY and presents David Sedaris' The Santaland Diaries, adapted by Joe Mantello, December 11th through the 23rd. For 10 years running, Flashpoint's Santaland Diaries brings Sedaris' lovable, curmudgeonly crumpet, the Macy's Elf, to life, making audiences laugh until they cry. Flashpoint Theater is located on Sansom Street, 2 blocks from the Avenue of the Arts. For tickets, 267-997-3312 or flashpointtheater.com.
Medical bills can cause serious sticker shock.
What? I'm paying all this for what?
Why do those procedures cost what they cost?
Because you called a CAT scan a $6,000 expense, it doesn't make it so.
I'm Megan Scott on the first episode of The Pulse, How to Untangle Medical Bills. Also, a doctor reveals a secret.
When I found out the next day, I was horrified.
The Pulse, Friday morning at 9, new on WHYY.
Made possible by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, from the farmer's market to the gas station, how one newlywed couple tried to live on the Bitcoin, the virtual currency, for 90 days.
Have you heard of Bitcoin?
Bitcoin.
Okay. It's a digital currency.
It's a what?
It's a digital currency. Okay. It's an online currency.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Dick Boak and Peter Zago about the history and the legacy of the Martin guitar. And I am surrounded by four beautiful old Martin guitars. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Peter, before the break, we were talking about this evolution of the American guitar and what C.F. Martin was doing. And you talked a bit about this Spanish influence. How did that change the shape of the kind of guitar, or even the design of the kind of guitar that he was working on?
The most profound change was something that we couldn't actually see unless you looked inside the guitar. As Dick mentioned, the top of a guitar acts like a drum head. It's a membrane. It has to vibrate. And Martin's guitars, before he discovered the Spanish guitars, had bracing to support the top that was parallel. It's called lateral bracing. Whereas the Spanish guitars had bracing that fanned out and was called fan bracing, and that offered all sorts of opportunities for more resonance, louder guitars, more sustain. And the rest of the changes were, one could see. And what's interesting is that if you look at the headstock of the top of the guitar of Martin today, it's a rectangular headstock, which is tapered. That, in fact, is Spanish.
Oh, interesting.
The shape of the contemporary Martin guitar body is Spanish. It's not Viennese. And virtually everything about the current Martin guitar he took from Spanish guitars. Even something that we call the Spanish heel, which is at the very end of the guitar neck, which we all take for granted as simply the right heel shape on a guitar, in fact, as the name says, is a Spanish heel, not what he used to do before he discovered Spanish guitars.
That's interesting. And from a, I guess, a player's perspective, Dick, is it dramatically different to play this fan design versus the more parallel horizontal line?
Well,
design rather.
You know, I think the real change happened in around 1842 or 1843. Where the fan bracing of the Spanish style and the Viennese styles morphed into an X-brace pattern. And Martin is really, really known for X-bracing. The Spanish guitars continue to be made today with the fan bracing, which is a very different thing. There's much less tension with gut or nylon strings. Steel strings really lend themselves well to the X-brace. But the X-brace was used very early, while nylon strings, gut strings were still being played. And this is where Madame Degoni comes into the picture. She was a very exotic performer from Spain, came over to New York City in the early 1840s. And the American public was enthralled with her, and she toured all over from, I think, Maine all the way down to Texas. She was kind of like the Bonnie Raitt of today.
Right.
And had a big following. She was probably one of the finest guitarists in the country. And she performed in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, close to Nazareth, and knew about Martin, had heard his reputation, and came to visit him. And placed an actually, she had her Spanish guitar with her, the fan-braced one, and she was telling him she's not going to be changing over to his guitars. And he had made something special for her. And he handed her the guitar, and she strummed it, and it was infinitely better.
Wow. And I'm sure she did a lot to promote the Martin guitar.
She did.
She toured the country.
And we actually started receiving orders in the logbooks. You can see orders for Degoni model repeated over and over, kind of the first signature model guitar that Martin made, really.
Although I think that who promoted who is I think, intriguing, because Madame Degoni promoted no one but Madame Degoni.
She just happened to have a Martin guitar.
A Martin guitar, and Martin certainly made a point of knowing that she was playing a Martin guitar.
Well, one gets the sense, and obviously we're talking about a company that has been, what, in the family for six generations, something like
181 years.
181 years, whatever, however many generations that produces.
Actually going on the seventh generation with Claire Frances Martin, C.F. Martin, and she's 9 years old at this point, and we're being very nice to her.
So it does continue, but he must have been a very good businessman, Peter.
He certainly was, and he was a good retailer. He was good at building partnerships, business partnerships. He was very flexible. We expected, as we tried to figure out how he got from point A to point B to point C and is thinking about changing the guitar, that it would be a straight line chronology. Well, of course it wasn't.
Yes.
He did a bit of this. He did a bit of that. After all, he was responding to what customers asked for, and he was very flexible.
But the book also, you write in the book, or the writers in your book talk about the fact that it seems like within about a 20-year period, he and some of these others create this American guitar, that it happened very quickly.
It happened even faster than 20 years. One of the significance of the Madame Degoni guitar is that it happens to be the first one that we can actually document that is X-braced. He may have made earlier ones before that, but this is the one we know. So it's truly a milestone guitar, and that is dated 1843. So, in fact, he had come upon what we think of as the Martin guitar today by 10 years after his arrival in America.
Yeah. And it seems, Dick, that the making of this guitar continues to evolve. It's been years, but I remember taking a tour of the factory maybe 10 or 20 years ago.
And you didn't ask for me?
I didn't ask for you. I'm so sorry.
You know, one of the funny things is that the small guitars are not as loud as big guitars, and banjos were prevalent. Banjos were kind of a conspiracy that were trying to take over the country. And this, I'm sure this was pretty frustrating for guitar players to be playing along with them and not having the volume. And I think that was one of the first things where the guitar started to grow in size, needing more volume to compete with the other instruments. And this continued size 5, size 4, size 3.5, size 2, size 1. Size, they ran out of numbers and went to size 0, each one getting a little bit larger, from 0 to 00 to 000, which in German was triple ought.
Right.
And then eventually to the large guitar, the dreadnought guitar, which is kind of the flagship of our heritage, really. All of them sharing the basic design principles of these early X-braced Martin guitars that started in 1843.
And we are talking about the history, the legacy of the Martin guitar, and that's Dick Boak. He's director of museum archives and special projects for Martin Guitar. He's been working for the company for 37 years. He's a writer, a graphic artist, a woodworker himself, has an interesting story to tell about how he began working at Martin Guitar. Also with us, Peter Zago, and he's a scholar collector of American guitars and banjos, co-author of this new book called Inventing the American Guitar, The Pre-Civil War Innovations of C.F. Martin and His Contemporaries. And again, this note, the New York Metropolitan Museum of Art is mounting a Martin guitar exhibit starting on January 14th. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have David from Fox Chase joining us on Radio Times. And David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Marty. And hi, Dick. I own a number of Martin guitars. I have a 0016, a 008, I'm sorry, a 0016, 0018, and a D1220.
Right.
My question had to do with the Sitka spruce that comes from Canada. I think that's what you use for your soundboard. What is going to be the alternative, and what is the supply currently of Sitka spruce? Is that endangered?
Well, there's actually many, many different types of spruce that we've used and that we're using. Adirondack spruce from the Adirondack Mountains of New York, and it also grows in Tennessee. Engelmann spruce from the Rocky Mountains. Sitka spruce, which grows from Oregon all the way up to Alaska. You know, if these woods were managed correctly, we would have a long supply of them, and the problem has been that they've been forested pretty heavily. Mm. We've been trying to work with a number of environmental groups to achieve some sustainability with these woods, not only spruce but all the other woods. But there are lots and lots of different types of spruces from Europe, Carpathian Mountains, Italian Alps, all over Canada, even Russia. And so I don't think it's going to be a tremendous problem, but it's certainly one we want to focus on and promote the responsible forestry.
David, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Peter, going back to the 19th century, as you said, the wood of choice, I guess, back then was this Brazilian rosewood. And I'm trying to imagine in the 19th century what it took to get that wood up to Nazareth, Pennsylvania.
I don't know. As a matter of fact, I do.
You do?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, you know, the wood was shipped in log form, and it came up along the Hudson River to a number of sawmills that were lined up along the Hudson River. C.F. Martin would go to the docks where the logs were unloaded. He would select logs, and then the logs would be transported somehow over to a nearby sawmill where he would supervise the cutting. And this was circular saw cutting. And this happened all the way up into the 1950s and 60s that these mills were cutting wood for Martin guitars. Now the Brazilian rosewood is restricted and not available,
right.
So we're using other types of woods, Indian rosewood and number of other varieties, and mahogany.
And you're also using more high-tech or high technology in order to make Martin guitars these days.
Yeah,
no surprise there.
It's really important to maintain hands-on hand craftsmanship. And I think people that come to the factory see many of the same processes that were used by C.F. Martin Sr. In the hand assembly of the guitars. But when you're preparing parts, cutting them out, and especially with all the competition there is for guitars, you've got to be efficient, and you've got to cut these parts out using the best technology, CNC machines and computer-aided design.
Let me see what John from Higgins, Pennsylvania has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, hello, Dick. I know you personally, and I greatly love the history of the museum. My question had to do with the X-brace that you just mentioned. Now, the earliest example was 1943. At what point did...
1843, John.
Yes, 1843. I apologize for
that.
Yeah, for 1843, I own an 1857 Martin myself. And then at what point did the X-brace become the brace of choice for Martin? And with that, that was my question.
Sure.
And at that point, I will hang up to hear what you have to say.
you did all the right things there, John. Can I actually just toss it to you, Peter, and then I'll get you back in on the conversation, Dick?
As I mentioned before, Martin experimented, did a bit of this, a bit of that. And from 1839, 1840 through 1846 or so, he was often imitating the Spanish guitar and at the same time developing the X-bracing. So I would say by 1846 or 47, he was pretty much doing X-braced guitars. He had settled into that.
Does that square with your history as well?
Yeah, the X-bracing is like a scissors. It distributes all the tension of the top. Guitars want to fold themselves in half from that tension. It distributes it all onto the shoulders of the guitar and lightens up the area of the bridge that needs to vibrate and produce the tone. And so he had a better design with less wood, producing better tone, and just caught on.
You have an interesting history with the Martin Guitar Company, and I was reading your webpage about your dumpster diving finding pieces of wood and so doing things on your own, and then it sounds like kind of convincing them to hire you over time.
Well, I guess I have to tell the story yet another time, but it is a good story. I grew up with Elvis and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and I loved music, and I listened to my little Panasonic, and I started building instruments in my father's shop in the basement around the age of 12.
Wow.
Really bad instruments, I have to tell you. And there weren't any books or anything. I eventually, after college, I got a job in Blairstown, New Jersey, teaching at Blair Academy, and I was teaching art, woodworking, interested in instruments. And to get to Blairstown, I had to drive right through Nazareth, and I saw a billboard for the company Factory Tours, which we still offer.
Yep.
And I stopped in and I took the tour and I was just flabbergasted. I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen the woods and the construction techniques, and I was making things out of old oak doors. So I asked the receptionist if there was a dumpster or any scrap material, and she sent me around to the side of the building, and I brought my car around, and I filled my car up, and I came back an hour later, and I filled it up again.
A lot of really nice wood, I would think.
Over the course of, the 4 years of my teaching, I came back probably 500 times. I had every wood shop in the area filled with Martin scraps, and I started to get good pieces, and eventually left teaching. And opened a little gallery in Bethlehem and kept coming to the dumpster. And one day the foreman of the shop, Harvey Samuels, his name was, everybody was Pennsylvania Dutch, and he came out and he said, well, what do you do with the stuff anyhow? And I handed up two instruments, and he said, do you mind if I parade them around the shop once? And off he went, and he ran into Chris Martin's grandfather. Chris is our current CEO.
Right.
And Mr. Martin, he always wanted to be called Fred, but we always said, yes, Mr. Martin. And he looked at the instruments and he said, tell that kid to apply for a job.
Wow.
Well, I was a bit of a hippie, and Harvey brought the instruments back and said, your old man says you should apply for a job, as C-H-O-B. And I brushed off and ponytailed my hair and went around to the front of the building and said, I'd like to apply for a job. And the receptionist said, I don't think we have anything for you.
Checking you out.
Yeah.
Right?
And so I said, well, any openings? One opening, design drafting. I've been doing design drafting for 10 years, been teaching it for 4 years. She said, we're really looking for somebody with some woodworking experience. I said, well, here's some jewelry boxes and lathe turnings that I've made from your scraps. And she said, well, we're really looking for somebody with guitar and music experience. And I said, well, here's two guitars I made, and the old man says I should apply for a job. So they interviewed me and said, can you start tomorrow? And I said, no, I have to go to the Bob Dylan concert, but I can start on Wednesday. So that was 37 years ago, and
wow.
and I would have done the job for free. I really would have. I just immersed myself, and it's just such a fantastic product and such a tool for artistic expression. It's a joy to come to work every day.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That was Dick Boak, one of our two guests in this hour of Radio Times. He is a writer, a graphic artist, a woodworker, director of museum archives and special projects for Martin Guitar, giving us a short history of his 37 years at Martin. Also with us is Peter Sago. He's a scholar and a collector of American guitars and banjos and co-editor of this new book called Inventing the American Guitar, the Pre-Civil War Innovations of C.F. Martin and His Contemporaries. And as I said, I am looking at four absolutely gorgeous Martins here in our Philadelphia studio. And we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation and our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
University City Science Center supports WHYY. In Greater Philadelphia, innovation means business, and the Science Center is at the core of that business. They unite our region's entrepreneurial ecosystem, convening the resources, funders, and people that move ideas forward. For more than 50 years, the Science Center has helped transform ambition into success, fueling the growth that strengthens our region. The University City Science Center. More information at sciencecenter.org. That's sciencecenter.org.
On the next Fresh Air, singer-songwriter Mark Mulcahy is in our studio to perform songs from his first album in 8 years, the first since his wife died. Writer Rick Moody called it among the very best records of 2013, and he describes Mulcahy as a remarkable songwriter. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The season of giving inspires the impulse of giving and drives the logic of giving.
Effective altruism. It's important because it combines both the heart and the head.
philosopher Peter Singer on making charitable giving that's something from the head and very little heart. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowin, again talking about the history and the legacy of the Martin guitar with Peter Sago and Dick Boak. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Peter, I know there's a story in here because it's included in the book about how this book literally came to be and the kind of, brainstorming sessions that you and others have had to put this history together. And this is the history of this guitar back in the 19th century, not the 20th century.
Not only the 19th century, but before the Civil War.
So exactly.
It's pre-war Martins, but it's pre-Civil War Martins. I saw some of the very early guitars in the Martin Museum and other places and tried to figure out how Martin got from these early guitars into the iconic Martin guitar. Right. And it ended up that we knew nothing whatsoever about this. A colleague of mine, in fact, a local dealer here, Fred Oster, and I did a database of all the guitars we could find from this period, and there were very, very few. So we decided, what do you do in that case? You have a conference. We collected experts on Martin, and we collected as many guitars as we could find. I think we probably had 30, which was at least 50% more than we knew about before we started looking for them, and we placed them around the room in a circle, and we moved them like chess men on a chessboard as we came to new insights about the guitars. And I should mention that the Martin Archives has the most astounding wealth of original documents from the history of the Martin Company, but they are missing business journals from 1840 to 1850. They have all the rest, but that period from 1840 to 1850 is critically important, we discovered. And since the documentary information wasn't there, we actually had to look to the instruments to try and figure out what was going on in C.F. Martin's mind. And Dick mentioned the importance of X-bracing. I just to give one example of how he must have thought, if you have braces fanned out like on a Spanish guitar, all Martin had to do was to remove the center brace and extend the two fanned braces on the outside, and suddenly there was X-bracing. It was that simple.
But was that one of those aha moments? You've got all these guitars lined up, and you begin to see over time how he was thinking about how this guitar, how he wanted to make a guitar.
Yes, and that's when we discovered the early Martin guitars, or the early Spanish-style Martin guitars, and realized that this was a critically important inspiration for him.
What I think is so interesting, and I think so obvious at this point, and I'll toss this to you, Dick, which is that a guitar or Martin guitar is an instrument, but these are works of art.
Well, yeah, I always consider them works of art first, and then they become a musical tool for experiment, like a paintbrush in a painter's hand. And speaking of art, I have to compliment Peter on the incredible project that he put together with the two conferences that we held about the early guitars, which led to a discussion about wouldn't it be great to do a book?
Yeah.
And then the book led to the really unprecedented exhibit of pre-1867 instruments at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the best museum in the world, and we're very, very excited about that. It's going to be a terrific year at the Met with a lot of peripheral events surrounding the exhibit.
Did you find that there were people that had old Martin, 19th century Martin guitars in their attic somewhere, or behind a pile of something or other? I mean, did you have stories like that?
We always have stories like that as collectors.
Yes, exactly.
We treasure those stories. We also found a number of great early Martin guitars that were in pieces in luthiers' workshops, and they had had them there for years and years, and they said, you know, someday we're going to get to restoring this one. Well, wow. They weren't getting to it, so we asked them if we could move ahead in restoring them. So that was another great opportunity for finding old ones.
You're a collector of American guitars and banjos. You always have to ask a collector, how many do you have? Do you know?
More than enough.
Whoever dies with the most wins.
Is that, how many do you have, Dick?
Oh, you know, I don't know if my wife is listening. I continue to hide them in up in my guitar room. But the I think about 60 or 65. Wow. You can't play them all at once. You know, they're just wonderful to have.
There's also this ledger. This on radio, you can't do justice to this beautiful ledger that you brought in. And this is a ledger from, I guess, from C.F. Martin. We see, first of all, 1836 to 1839. I just saw on the spine of the book there. First of all, he has absolutely gorgeous handwriting, and perhaps
quill pen.
Tells us something,
you know,
about him.
Keeping track of every single transaction. Amazing business. You know, it really documents how business was conducted and the types of things that people were interested in musically. This is one of many, many dozens of journals and day books and things that contributed to Peter's book.
I do want to get back to our callers, but I also just at some point, Dick, I'd love before the end of the show just have you kind of noodle around on this guitar that you brought in as well. Let me get, it looks like Ron from Graduate Hospital to join us on Radio Times. And Ron, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, there. I'm an authorized Martin repairman, and I work out of Philadelphia. Hi, Dick, it's Ron Ruggiero.
Hi.
And hey, anyway, I am actually working on a 1949 D28 while we speak. And the amazing thing about this is it's owned, the owner is the original owner. And after 64 years, Martin is going to authorize repairs on this guitar.
Wow.
So it's pretty cool. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful instrument.
And how much in need of repair is it, Ron?
Actually, it's in great shape. I think it had some repairs done previously, but the top is beautiful. It just, the bridge needs to be re-glued and a small bridge plate, and then some fretwork. But it's amazing. You call up Martin, they look back, and they say, "Yeah, Bill Green originally owns it," and they take care of the work. So, amazing company, beautiful guitars, and that's all I just want to say.
Ron, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Anything you want to say in response, Dave?
Well, it certainly pays to live a long life if you get a Martin guitar in your teen years or something like that, but. The Martin warranty is pretty legendary, and you know we stand behind the product pretty nicely. People sometimes abuse guitars; we can't take care of that. But if there's other problems that are, you know, our responsibility, we step up to the plate.
Peter, this book is largely about C.F. Martin, but as you said, there were some other guitar makers in those early days, and certainly there are guitar makers now. Can you say, though, that C.F. Martin Americanized the guitar, that what he created became what we think of as the American guitar?
Without question. I think there was one other guitar maker, though, that contributed a great deal to what we now think of as the American guitar trade, and that was James Ashbourne. And whereas Martin was the prototypical German, James Ashbourne was the Connecticut Yankee. And we know very little about him, but somewhere in the early 1840s, he started making each year three times the amount of guitars that Martin did. And whereas Martin always had the Martin stamp on his guitar, Ashbourne would private label his guitars for the major distributors, and he was truly manufacturing them just as gun makers and clock makers and furniture makers would be manufacturing their products along the Connecticut River Valley. He made guitars for about 15 years. We don't know where he learned how to make guitars. We don't know, in fact, what happened to him afterward, but his guitars are wonderful. And he contributed the mass marketing and mass production.
And do they sound different from a Martin, do you think?
They sound great.
They sound great.
They sound great, yeah.
I don't think so, Peter. I wanted to say that, you know, it's very difficult. Ashbourne didn't survive as a company. It's very difficult for a company to survive one generation, let alone two, three, four, five, six, seven. C.F. Martin Sr. Passed away. C.F. Jr. came into the picture, and then his son, Frank Henry Martin, and then his son, C.F. Martin III, and then Frank Herbert Martin, and Chris Martin, C.F. Martin IV, who, under his direction, the company has grown really incredibly. Yeah. It's a pretty remarkable family business story of adjusting and flexibility and survival.
In fact, during the 80s, there was a question about whether the Martin Guitar Company would survive.
Yeah. We dropped to, I think, 3,000 guitars a year, and now we're making more than, I think, more than 100,000 instruments. And each one, you know, hand done.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what... I just asked you to play a little bit more only because we have it set up, and you've got this beautiful, very old Martin guitar. You dig that you spent a fair amount of time, I don't know if you still do it, building geodesic domes. Do you still do that?
Well, I had the great pleasure of meeting Buckminster Fuller, and that was a high point of my life. Yeah. I have to say, guitars are my focus now, and it's just such a great honor to have been able to work with Peter on this great project.
Let me get that. Looks like Nick from Glen Mills to join our conversation. Nick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Sure.
I read that the entertainer Sting went to Martin Guitar with a very specific request. He said he wanted the sound of tinkling glass, but he wanted it to come from a guitar. My question is, how do you determine that that's possible and how you're going to get it?
Well, and did he say that or request that?
You know, I don't remember that exact comment, but Sting loves small guitars, parlor guitars, the type that were originated around 1916 in conjunction with the Ditson Company. And there's a small guitar called a Size 5. Sting was interested in it. He had seen one. And we made a special Sting model called the Sting Mini. Hmm. We were going to call it the Mini Sting. He didn't like that. And the small guitar has a very crystalline, you might say glassine, glass-like tone. Especially, he wanted it strung with strings that were an octave above pitch. Oh. And he uses this in kind of a drone, almost banjo roll type of way. And I think this is what you're referring to is the Sting Mini guitar.
Peter, do you think there's still, you know, pre-Civil War Martin guitars out there somewhere that someone might not know exists?
I think there are a lot, yes. We uncovered, I think, three or four times more than we knew about when we started this project 5 years ago. And we touched upon, you asked us about collecting guitars.
Yes.
And
are you going to come clean and tell us how many you have?
Well, I do want to offer all the collectors out there some advice, and that is when my wife and I moved into our old farmhouse, she allowed me to put guitars in a couple of rooms, but she made sure that there were banjo-free and guitar-free zones in our house.
And, you know, there's this thing called
I'll have to think about that, but yeah, go ahead.
Do you know about gas? A lot of these guitar players have gas, which is a guitar acquisition syndrome.
Oh, is that what it's called these days?
It's quite a
thing.
That's
the diagnosis.
And, you know, they're so special. There are a lot of collectors. Peter has an incredible collection of guitars and beautiful, beautiful banjos as well. It's nice to have them around. It's nice to play them.
I also, and we're almost out of time here, but I also get the feeling that we're in a kind of acoustic guitar renaissance. I mean, as you said, Martin guitar doing very, very well. But you read about, you know, small luthiers that are making specialty guitars. Do you see
There's a lot of boutique makers.
Oddly,
most of them are copying the Martin design because Martin has had so much success with these designs that the Dreadnought, the orchestra model, the auditorium guitars are pretty much the standard of the industry, and they're widely copied. With the folk music and the folk rock, Paul Simon and rock and roll and MTV Unplugged and now Americana music with Mumford & Sons and the Avett Brothers and all these new acoustic guitar bands, acoustic guitars sound better.
Yeah.
You know, when you tune those electrics up to 11 and have to put the earplugs in, it's not a very pleasant experience, but acoustic music is pure.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Dick Bogue, thank you very much.
Thank you. I hope you come up and see the factory. We'd love to see all of you.
Well, that would be great. And he's a writer, graphic artist, a woodworker, director of museum archives and special projects for Martin Guitar. Peter Sago, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And again, a scholar, a collector of guitars and banjos, and co-editor of this new book called Inventing the American Guitar, the Pre-Civil War Innovations of C.F. Martin and His Contemporaries. And just to reiterate here, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York is mounting a Martin guitar exhibit, and it starts on January 14th. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. And in fact, check us out on Facebook, because we took a whole bunch of photos of these beautiful guitars, and you can check them out at our Facebook page. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Jessica Crocker, our intern for today. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.